Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Eric Westervelt, and this is On Point. Paul Manafort's trial continues with damaging testimony from his former deputy, Rick Gates. Here's NBC's Ken Delanian.
He is saying we committed tax fraud, we committed bank fraud together, and Mr. Manafort was directing that.
And in the midterms, an Ohio race is too close to call, and history made in Michigan. Rashida Tlaib will become the first Muslim woman to serve in Congress.
This is it. It is possible. And all the ugliness and the hatred that you hear out there, it's not who we are. It really isn't as a country.
And Vice President Mike Pence announces the administration wants a sixth branch of the U.S. military, the U.S. Space Force.
Our adversaries have transformed space into a warfighting domain already. And the United States will not shrink from this challenge.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Bloomberg's Margaret Taleb, the Dallas Morning News' Michael Lindenberger, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air and online. Congressman Chris Collins indicted for insider trading. Devin Nunes suggests Republicans need to protect President Trump from the Russia investigation. Is the swamp starting to stink? Join the conversation or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Margaret Taleb, senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Margaret, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Dallas, Texas, Michael Lindenberger, an editorial writer, columnist, and member of the editorial board of the Dallas Morning News. Michael Lindenberger, welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point's news analyst, Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Eric, Margaret, and Michael.
Hey, Jack.
Thanks to all. And I guess I want to start with you, Margaret. Prosecutors in the fraud and conspiracy trial of Paul Manafort, you know, expect to rest their case today. President Trump, of course, came to Washington saying he's going to drain the swamp. But the trial of Manafort, you know, Trump's former campaign chairman, and the federal indictment for alleged insider trading of a well-known Republican congressman close to the president, it's a little swampy. Catch us up on the Manafort trial.
Yeah, I mean, it's been, this week has been important, and this case has been important for a few reasons. One is the optics that you've talked about. The other is that this is, in some sense, the first real test of Mr. Manafort's work and kind of the extended tentacles of what he's able to bring to bear. And it is laid bare in this testimony, Rick Gates's testimony, so much of the detail, not just about what Mr. Gates was involved in, but what Mr. Manafort was allegedly involved in, and the extent of some of the, not just the relations with Russian or pro-Russian Ukrainian forces, but the money at stake, the personal relationships at stake, the extent to which there was a covering of one's tracks and a dishonesty about where the money was going and what the relationships looked like. And you can see, theoretically, how all of that could be brought to bear as the investigation proceeds, to the extent that they can tie it ever to any of those other relationships in the Trump circle or to the context that happened leading up and through the election. So that's been important. On this question of how the swamp issue plays with the Trump base, I think that's there's a lot less, you know, kind of certainty about that. I mean, thus far, the president's base is absolutely stuck by him and has not particularly been shaken by Scott Pruitt or any of those sort of issues. So I think we'll see. There's sort of, when you look outside of that circle, not the core Trump supporters, but kind of swing voters, maybe people who voted for President Obama in 2008 or 2012, and then for President Trump in 2016. There are a lot of people like that, believe it or not, and this may shake kind of their thinking on their choice. And some of the Republicans who are more traditional, not so much Trump-based Republicans, but establishment Republicans, it may affect their thinking heading into this midterms.
Heading into the midterms. And Michael Lindenberger, I want to ask you, I mean, offshore bank accounts, fraudulent loan documents, extravagant wardrobes that might make Elton John blush. I mean, what, though, if anything, do you think this says, as Margaret was talking about, this says about the impact on President Trump. One listener writes on our Facebook page, why should anyone care about this? This is Washington corruption. It's not new.
You know, I think the challenge for those who see a connection between Manafort and Trump is that this trial has shown very clearly just how swampy Manafort is. But for Trump, he says, "Hey, I didn't know." You know, and I think for a lot of folks that support Trump, they're not going to be moved by the corruption that's being exposed in this trial or alleged in this trial. And I think that's a challenge for Mueller. I think as he brings this needs to be the opening act, and then a second or third act to connect this to the president.
Carl is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I tell you, no one should be surprised at this type of stuff that's going on under Donald Trump. I mean, this is a guy whose business dealings have been, to make it mildly, shady over the years. So to see his supporters, these evil evangelical hypocrites, to just go along with it, you know, the family values group, the Christian, more Christian than anybody else in the world, these are the people that are standing by him, supporting them, and they should be, no pun intended, indicted along with the crew that's with Donald Trump.
Carl, thanks for your call. And Jack Beatty, I want you to weigh in here, because this trial does not have anything directly to do with Russia and collusion, but it is Robert Mueller's first trial in his probe of that. What should listeners make about its impact potentially on the larger Mueller probe?
Well, I don't know about the Mueller probe, but it certainly has an impact on public perception of a culture of corruption in this administration. The president said, "I will hire the best people in the world." Here's a list of people who were pled to guilty to crimes or who are charged with it. Trump's second campaign manager, Trump's deputy campaign manager, Trump's national security advisor, Trump's foreign policy advisor, Trump's first congressional endorser. Three cabinet secretaries have resigned in disgrace. This week, ProPublica reports that the Department of Veterans Affairs is virtually being run by a cabal of cronies from Mar-a-Lago who call the secretary and people there and tell them what to do, and who stand to gain, perhaps, by privatizing the VA. Then we come to Wilbur Ross. Forbes this week does an expose of him. He may have stolen, according to Forbes, $120 million from his partners and his customers. The article sort of depicts him as a gorgon of greed. He goes when he goes to the coffee shop, he takes big handfuls of sweet and low and puts them in his pocket so he won't have to pay. And you can see why Trump likes him, because somebody there is quoted as saying he's a pathological liar. Well, that would be right in Trump's wheelhouse. And, you know, you have to ask yourself, why is Trump attracted to these people, these swamp rats, you could call? Well, because people who, you know, he's a sort of grifter himself, and these people are grifters, and grifters don't peach on other grifters unless they're faced with jail time. And you know, this, as I say, this happens just when the emoluments litigation is proceeding about Trump, just as when we're hearing more and more about these hotels raking in the money, and of course without Trump's tax returns to examine.
Margaret Taleb, I want to ask you. I mean, it seems like a lifetime ago, but in Washington and Trumplandia, a week can seem like a long time. But the week kicked off with the president admitting in a tweet that this infamous 2016 meeting in Trump Tower with Russians was indeed about getting potential dirt on his rival Hillary Clinton. How damaging was that potentially legally for the president when it comes to Special Counsel Mueller's investigation?
You're right. That was like not even a week ago. You know, I think when you look at all of these things, you have to look at them on two fronts. And one is how they play in terms of public relations. And then the second is how they play in terms of the Mueller probe. And when you're thinking about midterm elections, how they play in the court of public opinion is much more important. When you're looking long term at the arc of this presidency, at whether a second term is possible, at whether there's actually any legal jeopardy for the president or anyone in his sphere of influence, you have to look at the implications on the Mueller probe. And all that has ever mattered in the Mueller probe is the timeline, the facts that can be proven to be facts, things like telephone conversations, meetings, emails, testimony from other people, things for which there are, you know, corroboration. So every time the president says something that is completely different than the original story, it creates another element, certainly that Mueller and his team would want to ask, in theory, the president about, and definitely other people about. And it attaches to all these potential issues that folks in the White House or Trump world are concerned about, which is, you know, perjury or obstruction type of issues, not just with the president, but with other people who have been asked to testify or who will be asked to testify. And that is the issue, is that when a story is so dramatically different, you know, is it going to affect the midterm elections? I don't know. Is it going to affect the questions that Mr. Mueller and his team are asking, the timelines that they're trying to put together, and the questions of motivation for everything that has happened in between? Yes, of course.
Michael Lindenberger, from your perch in Dallas, fairly briefly, I'm just curious your take on this. Do you think people really care about it out there?
I think people care. I think the people that don't care are the diehard Trump supporters. And I think what they like is what J.D. Vance wrote about in the Hillbilly Elegy. They like the way Trump talks to elites. He talks down to them. He insults them. And they overlook a lot else. And I think for the traditional Republicans who have held their nose and probably disdain a lot of what Trump has done, but have remained silent, what they like are the results. They like the tax cuts. They like the deregulation. Those are things that they've wanted to get for a long time, and they're getting them in spades.
They like his tone, not necessarily what he promises. Lots more to come. We're talking with top reporters in Washington, New England, and in Texas about the weekend news. You can join the conversation. What did you see in this week's midterms? What did you see in the news? Signs of a blue wave this fall or red tide? I'm Eric Westerveld. There's more to come. You're listening to On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, Asma.
Hey, Scott.
Another crazy week. We've got North Korea.
Yep, we got Russia.
Midterms.
And, of course, President Trump. And what happens whenever there is crazy news that erupts? We pop into the studio and break it down to make sense.
So if you see a headline,
we've discussed it.
It's the NPR Politics Podcast.
It's On Point. I'm Eric Westerveld. We're looking at the week in the news, and you can join us, join the conversation. What'd you make of the first Muslim woman to be elected to Congress? The midterm primaries in Missouri, Ohio, and Kansas. Trump again tweets against NFL players who take a knee during the national anthem. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We have with us Bloomberg senior White House correspondent Margaret Talev, Dallas Morning News editorial writer and columnist Michael Lindenberger, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. And an audio that aired this week on MSNBC, California Republican Congressman Devin Nunes, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, told attendees at a private fundraiser that maintaining a GOP majority in Congress is imperative to protect President Trump from the Russia investigation.
If Sessions won't unrecuse and Mueller won't clear the president, we're the only one, which is really the danger. That's why I keep, and thank you for saying that, by the way. I mean, we have to keep all these things. We have to keep the majority. If we do not keep the majority, all of this goes away.
Margaret Talev, unpack that a little for us. If Sessions won't unrecuse and Mueller won't clear the president, he said, we're the only ones. We're the only ones. What's the impact of this recording?
Yeah, I mean, it's, to me, this recording is not shocking. To me, this recording reflects what a lot of Republicans in Congress are thinking, either because they support the president or because they support having a Republican president and a Republican majority. They understand that they're tied together. But what Nunes is saying is that Republican-controlled chambers of Congress are a major protection from the president, not just because in theory they are a safety valve if Mueller or Rosenstein or somebody, if the president wanted to sort of mess with that, but also in terms of the sort of investigations that could dog the president legislatively and how that might interplay with the Mueller probe next year. It is thought much more likely that the House is vulnerable to take over by the Democrats than the Senate, and there's different implications in the House or in the Senate in terms of when a party switches control. Obviously, in the Senate, you've got confirmations, and so that ends up sort of, by conventional wisdom, being a much more powerful tool. But if Democrats take over even one chamber of Congress, it could create an entirely different framework in which you would see most likely investigations ramp up and take over in terms of the agenda, investigations of the president and his team. It would see people being called for testimony who haven't been called for testimony, and you might really see a brakes on any legislative progress.
Let's move on to the midterms. Ohio Republican State Senator Troy Balderson declared victory Tuesday night in a still too close to call special election to replace retired Republican Congressman Pat Tibiri.
America is on the right path, and we're going to keep it going that way. It's time to get to work. Over the next 3 months, I'm going to do everything I can to keep America great again.
Jack, President Trump took some credit on Twitter, of course, for some wins during the midterms. I'm curious, I mean, was this really a win for Trump and Trumpism? This was a very red Ohio district, for example, that turned out to be pretty close.
Yeah, and experts point out that there are, I don't know, 60 or more other Republican districts that are less Republican than that are now vulnerable. But if I may, let me just divagate from the winner loser in that race.
Sure.
To looking at the role of the Green Party candidate, Joe Manchin is his name. Now this fellow. He got about, let's see here if I can see that, around 1,000 votes. And what separates the Democrat and the Republicans, about 1,500 votes. People are saying that if the Green Party guy hadn't been in it, maybe the race would have been forced to a recount. We don't know. We do know that Joe Manchin says that he's descended from space aliens. That didn't stop those noble soul Green Party people from voting for him. And you know, the nefarious role of this party in our politics can't be understated. I say one word alone, Ralph Nader. But then 2016, the role of the Jill Stein campaign. Jill Stein, who was, of course, at that 2015 meeting in Moscow, dinner party with Vladimir Putin and national security, soon to be national security advisor Flynn. She was right there at the table. She's denied any connections to Russia. The Senate committee is, in fact, investigating whether there were connections. But she sure spouted a lot of Russian talking points in the campaign. And her presence on the ticket made the difference in the three states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, that by a squeaker went from Trump. The Green Party has a lot to answer for.
Well, Jack Beattie, you have it in for the Green Party, but I mean, this is democracy, and a lot of folks are saying the two-party system just isn't serving us well.
Well, you know, I'm not going to come out and say it is, but I'm just pointing to the facts,
yeah,
and to the sort of aura of suspicion around the Jill Stein campaign in 2016.
Let's take some more calls. Al is calling from Greenville, South Carolina. Al, welcome to Friday and to On Point.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm what they call, I guess, a swing vote. I voted for Obama, and then I voted for our new president here, Donald Trump, and very disappointed. None of the people feel like they're being represented by any of the parties. the conflict of interest in both parties is terrible. I mean, I don't know what's going on in this country. You know, they're supposed to be representatives of the people when they go to Washington, D.C., and what we find is that they're not representing the people at all. You know, this thing with Donald Trump, that, you know, that with Russian collusion and all that, that's just a little drop in the bucket. I mean, everybody out there, is all those representatives that we have from the states are representing all their countries and representing special interests and representing everybody except for the people that they're supposed to be representing.
Al, thank you for your call. We get the point. I think it's appreciated. I'm going to go to Michael in Dallas and just ask you, I mean, Al's alienated. Are you seeing sort of voters tuned out by the swamp, by the Russian investigation, by the whole ball of politics?
West? You know, I think Al's comments wrap together a lot of what we've been talking about, including the Green Party. I mean, clearly there were liberal folks who were just disaffected from the Democratic Party, and they went with the Green Party in 2016, just as they did in Al Gore's election. And I think Jack's right. There's a tremendous cost. They've had a deleterious effect on any kind of progressive agenda. Hmm. But they are honest in their disaffection, I think. And the same thing with the right. I think they were looking for something that they saw in Donald Trump. I think the hope for those who hope that his tenure is short is that they'll realize that they were sold something they didn't get. That wasn't delivered.
Michael, I want to follow up with you. I mean, Texas has not elected a Democrat statewide office, as I understand it, more than 20 years. But there's a Democrat, Congressman Beto O'Rourke. His Senate campaign is giving Republican incumbent Ted Cruz a bit of a challenge. Tell us about O'Rourke and what this challenge might mean symbolically or otherwise.
Well, there's a couple things to keep in mind. One is Texas is reliably red. I mean, the governor is far ahead of his Democratic challenger, who's from Dallas. But this race with Cruz and Beto O'Rourke is different, and it's for a couple of reasons. One is Cruz is a very divisive figure. He went to Congress, went to the Senate as a member of the Tea Party and was, you know, primarily interested in obstructing and stopping what he saw was Washington's wrong direction. But he wasn't much of a lawmaker and didn't really pay a lot of attention to constituent services, for instance, and was building his own campaign for president. Hmm. So he's been very divisive. The mainstream sort of business-focused Republican Party treated him with very stiff arms for a long time. Hmm. But on the other hand, Beto O'Rourke is a very strong candidate. People respond to him extremely positively. The challenge for him is about 800,000 votes.
That's a big challenge.
That go the other way typically. Right. So he's hoping that Cruz will lose enough votes and he'll gain enough, and that's not going to be easy.
But he's young and dynamic. And Margaret, I want to ask you, I mean, Senator Cruz, of course, was famously mocked by Trump during the race as, you know, Lion Ted. He's obviously not close to the president, and he's distanced himself from the president. But talk about a little bit how candidates like Cruz have to kind of walk a line in this, in some of these races. We head into the midterms where Trump is popular, but sometimes they might have to go against him.
I mean, actually, when you look at the way Donald Trump campaigned against Ted Cruz, it's a miracle that Ted Cruz could actually muster kind of the political necessity to embrace him when he has. And he has for a lot of the time that has passed, a lot of the first year and a half of the Trump administration. I think what you have in Texas is kind of this, it's not a perfect storm because it's probably not going to be enough of a storm to really change what's going on. But you have a very interesting storm where it is exactly, as Michael said, this combination of Cruz being almost kind of like a divisive within his own party, and then Beto O'Rourke just being like a good candidate. Whatever you think about his ideology and his policies, he's a stronger candidate than some Democratic challengers in solidly red places, right? And he's got some political experience now himself. But you see it. It's been different. Like, you've seen how Ted Cruz has dealt with President Trump. You've seen how Marco Rubio, another challenger, another one of the competitors in the 2016 race, has kind of, sometimes he's supportive of Trump, and other times he'll take a stand against him. But, you know, it just sort of depends on the circumstances. And then you see a guy like Governor Kasich out of Ohio, who's just basically not even pretending anymore at all. And you saw that play out with the LeBron James situation. And you see it play out with, you know, we're in Ohio waiting for the president to land on Air Force One, and Kasich is not on the tarmac to greet him. So I think it's been different with many Republicans who ran against Trump for that nomination in 2016. But in Cruz's case, you have this combination of his personality, O'Rourke's characteristics, and a state that is changing, but probably not changing fast enough to make that difference.
We're talking
by
about
November, and yet very closely watched.
Well, can I just jump in on that?
I think
it's a remarkable race. I mean, Beto O'Rourke has outraised Ted Cruz without using PAC donations and simply blown him away in sort of head-to-head campaign fundraising. And, you know, the polls are extremely tight. There's one that came out last week that put him at 2% behind within the margin of error. Now, that hasn't been replicated by other polls, but it's a pretty shocking – I mean, Texas is extremely red. So that's extremely interesting. I wouldn't put a lot of money on his race. I think the odds are with Cruz. But it's a lot tighter, even by Cruz's own admission, than anybody expected.
Let's go to the phones. Karen is calling from Newton, Mass. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. My question has to do with the migrant children and their parents who have been separated by our government. And first, I want an update on it. Secondly, I want you to understand why it isn't front and center on the news. It seems like it's an issue that could grab the hearts and minds of just about any thinking person or feeling person. So thank you.
Thanks for your call, Karen. Michael, you're down near the border. Give us an update if you can and weigh in. Maybe why this hasn't been as prominent in the news as Karen and others think it should.
You know, the update is they're trying to reunite these kids, and they've failed to do that completely, although, you know, they did eventually reunite a bunch of them. I think the politics of this, at least in Texas, people are mostly abhor this policy. Whether or not the about-face by the administration sort of has eased that objection from more moderate or conservative voters, I don't know. I think it's likely. In terms of why it's not front and center, I think it's an aspect of the news. You know, you get tired of the same story. I think as a reader, as consumers, it doesn't seem as fresh, even though the stories that are coming out of these kids being separated still. Yesterday, the judge ordering the asylum seekers back from El Salvador. I mean, those are phenomenal and heart-wrenching stories. So I think they're still in the media, but there's a lot of news coming out these days.
I want to pivot a little bit to Charlottesville. Police and others in Charlottesville, Virginia, are bracing for what may come this weekend on the anniversary of the deadly white nationalist, white supremacist rally there. States of emergency were declared for the Commonwealth of Virginia and Charlottesville. Jack Beatty, as we come up on a year since last year's rallies, thoughts on where we've been in this last year when it comes to race in America?
Well, just using the Charlottesville frame alone, people point to all kinds of progress. For example, the Associated Press and other media don't use the phrase alt-right anymore because that's a euphemism for a racist, anti-Semitic group. That's not used. But just look at what hasn't changed. Look at Virginia. There's a candidate there, Corey Stewart, nominated by Republican voters to run for the Senate, who has an unsavory connection with neo-Nazis, with anti-Semites, with sentimentality for the let's bring back the Confederacy. Unbelievable that a major party would nominate this guy. Now, he's way behind in the polls, but the disgrace is he's nominated. And then look at the migration into the mainstream of the poison we saw at Charlottesville. Here you've got Laura Ingraham, the Fox News person, The other night, she says the America that we know and love doesn't exist anymore because of massive demographic changes. Here you've got Tucker Carlson on Fox saying Latin American countries are changing election outcomes by forcing demographic change on this country. One of the white nationalists said of Carlson, well, he's basically telling white America to prepare for war as directly as he can get away with it while remaining on Fox News. So you've got a Senate candidate from the neo-Nazi right. You've got white supremacist language creeping in on Fox News all the time, and you have Donald Trump as president, the president who could see no difference between the protesters, moral difference between the protesters and the neo-Nazis, and who disgraced his office by saying there were good people on both sides. Good for Mitch McConnell for saying there are no good neo-Nazis.
Racist poison seeping into the mainstream, Jack Beatty says. I want to talk a little bit more about that after the break. Michael Lindenberg, you recently called out the president on some of his racially charged tweets and comments. I want to ask you about that. We're talking about the week's biggest news stories. You can join the conversation. What about the tone President Trump is setting with his tweets? Is he finally getting tough on Russia with some of those sanctions? What about the renewed sanctions on Iran and the policy there? Where is that leading us internationally? I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Did cutting taxes actually grow the economy?
And what makes DJ Khaled the king of pop music?
The Indicator, a daily podcast where we tackle the big economic questions.
You're listening to On Point. I'm Eric Westervelt. In other news this week, fires still rage across big parts of California. Here's CBS's Jonathan Vigliotti in Riverside County.
Thousands of homes southeast of Los Angeles threatened by wildfire. Despite the all-out aerial assault, the Holy Fire continues to explode in size, a fire that officials say was deliberately set.
And there are shocking revelations about a compound in New Mexico where authorities found 11 starving children last week. Here's CNN's Scott McLean.
The defendant had trained the child in the use of an assault rifle in preparation for future school shootings.
And earlier this spring, the NFL imposed a rule requiring players to stand during the national anthem. In Thursday night's Miami Dolphins preseason opener, wide receiver Kenny Stills and others took a knee during the anthem.
Being a part of this protest hasn't been easy. And, you know, I thought I was going to be by myself out there.
Will this continue into the regular season?
I don't see why not.
You can join the conversation. What else was on your mind this week, on your radar? The trade war, immigration, free speech. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We have with us from the Dallas Morning News editorial writer and columnist Michael Lindenberger, Bloomberg senior White House correspondent Margaret Talev, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. And Jack, we're getting a lot of pushback. I push back a little on your Green Party comments, but on Twitter, Facebook, and on the phone lines about your comments. So let's open up the phone lines. Evan is calling from Maine. Evan, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Hi, how's it going?
It's good. So are you a Green Party supporter?
I wasn't sure which gentleman was talking about that, but I mean, he basically just dropped and then Ralph Nader happened, and we got George Bush. Is that fairly accurate? I mean, I'm oversimplifying it, but is that more or less what the gentleman was getting at, that we got?
Jack raised some questions about the Green Party. Yeah.
More or less.
Do you disagree?
Okay. Progressive candidates like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who are running on platforms such as a New Green Deal to uplift workers and poor people all over the world, all over the country, are influenced by people like Jill Stein, who in fact coined the, I believe, the term, the New Green Deal, and have been influencing progressive candidates around the country. Don't you think that plays a integral part, a pivotal role in shaping the policy of the parties? And don't you think that perhaps a more plurality of parties could benefit the country to create more choices? And in Maine, where we've just started ranked choice voting, which people talked about was going to be make everything confusing, but really it's helping create greater voice for more candidates and allowing third parties to actually stand a chance.
Evan, thanks for your call. Third parties, Jack Beatty, need to be heard.
I think he's right, and they have had a role in American history. Richard Hofstadter said that they're like bees, you know, they sting and usually die out, but having made a difference. Mm. I'm thinking of the People's Party of the 1890s, the Populist Party, notably, which in a way, quite like what our caller was saying, preluded the New Deal 40 years earlier. And he's saying that the Green Party, essentially gave a rehearsal of a better world, the world of, a Green Deal. I'm all for the Green Deal. But I think that, you have to look at the facts. And at least as I see them, they are as I laid them out. I don't see that, I don't think the Iraq War would have happened but for Ralph Nader's presence on the ticket in 2000. Now, maybe I'm totally wrong, but boy, that's a big thing to weigh against, changing the ideas of people and so on. I'm all for changing the ideas, but you've got to look at the facts. And then 2016, the Senate committee has brought Jill Stein in for questioning. She's denied any connection with Russia. I don't see that there's any connection with Russia. Nevertheless, her running mate in that campaign said that the shooting down of the Dutch airliner in Ukraine was a false flag operation. That wasn't a Russia operation. Why? Why did he say that? Who benefits from that talk? So, I take the caller's point. We need the duopoly, right, as Ralph Nader puts it, is a serious problem. But so is the effect of Green Party candidates, a serious problem.
I want to get back, Michael Lindenberger, to you and the tone the president has been setting with some of the tweets and comments. I mean, he tweeted today against NFL players, again. He said, be happy, be cool. I'm not sure what the heck that means. but he said, a football game that fans are paying so much money to watch and enjoy is no place to protest. Once again, taking on NFL players. Talk about the tone he's setting.
Well, I think there's two things here. One is just every time he insult somebody, he usually uses whatever the lowest denominator, ugliest associations he can. And when it happens to be minorities that he's talking about, he goes to racial stereotypes very easily. I think that creates a poison in our system that is amplified by the silence by people who are in Congress and who simply don't respond. They may not agree with him. They may feel like they distance themselves by silence, but that silence amplifies that message to people across the country. It's a real cancer, I think, in our public debate. As for the NFL, I can't think of a more respectful way to protest than to take a knee and quietly do so to try to bring attention to what is obviously a significant public issue. There can be debates about whether it's appropriate during the game or whatever, but this vitriol that the president has helped heap on these athletes is just astounding.
Let's go back to the phones. Todd is calling from Wisconsin. Todd, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Eric. I'm just calling to say I'm tired of losing. Here in Wisconsin, I was just talking to your screener, working at a future for farmers that's just bleak because of these trade practices. The futures on soybeans are so low that we're not going to be able to afford seed to put them back in. And also, as I was saying before, the futures for hog production are so low that we're not going to be even bothered to go into hog production. So I'm saying is that Wisconsin is that we're not winning. We're losing.
Todd, thanks for your call. Margaret, to you, the trade war is tired of losing.
Yeah, the implications of the president's trade policies are still playing out. And the president, I think, pretty early on recognized the intense skepticism and concern by many Midwestern politicians and people in the industry, and has sought very hard. You know, they've got these Make Farmers Great Again hats or whatever, and he goes to every rally and talks about how much he loves farmers and the ag community. But the proof is going to be, you know, in the pudding. And so I think this is a really big test, and what the caller said is really important and something to watch. We can talk about free speech issues, you know, professional athletes taking a knee, stuff that has nothing to do with why should this be an issue of regulation. But when it comes to the economy, the president certainly wants to run on the economy. The sort of the favorable numbers that seem to have emerged from since the passage of the tax cuts, GDP, and that sort of thing. But there's a big concern among many inside the White House and inside the Republican Party that this could at least, you know, kind of undo the bump of that and perhaps even offset it further. There's concerns about implications next year after these midterms on the economy in a more long-term setting. And I think, you know, you see the president on the one hand kind of trying to address those issues, and on the other hand, this latest wave of sanctions on Turkey that's now been announced, and not just sanctions but tariffs. What are the implications of trade wars with China? There is a lot of consternation and a lot of concern as the real impact of this takes a while to play out.
Yeah, we should mention the Turkey, as Margaret did, that Turkey has now been hit with new tariffs on steel and aluminum. The president tweeting just recently this morning, I just authorized a doubling of tariffs of steel and aluminum with respect to Turkey as their currency slides rapidly downward. Michael Lindenberger in Red State, Texas, you know, the economy is doing well. The stock market is up, unemployment down. Is there support for digging in on a trade war?
You know, Texas is hugely involved in international trade. It's the largest exports, I think, come from Texas, maybe second largest. So this idea of starting a trade war has not gone over well with traditional Texas politicians. But the question I have is for Congress. They could easily change this. They've given the president authority to use national security as a trigger for these tariffs up to 25%. All they have to do is rescind that or take it back. And they're simply scared to do that before the midterms. And it really is on them. I think Mitch McConnell, John Cornyn, all those folks are deeply supportive of international trade, but they've remained almost silent.
Let's go back to the phone. Lawrence is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Lawrence, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Eric. Part of the Republicans failing their oath of office by protecting Trump is that they've been stonewalling the senatorial Democrats from acquiring the records on the Kavanaugh nomination. And Richard Blumenthal was on Rachel Maddow last night on MSNBC stating that they were going to have to submit FOIA requests to circumvent the Republican senatorial blockage of their access of the records. That's all I have to say. I think it's pathetic that they're not honoring their oath of office by defending the Constitution of the United States.
Thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, blocking access to Kavanaugh documentation?
Yes, Senator Blumenthal said this is the first time that this has ever happened, that the Senate party in the Senate has had to, resort to a FOIA request to get documents. And he contrasted this stonewalling about Kavanaugh's White House days with the flood of documents that the Obama administration gave over to the Senate when his nomination was, and I'm trying to think of the name of Elena Kagan, when she was, thank you, right. Elena Kagan, when she was nominated, she had worked in the administration and they gave a ton of documents. And they're saying, hey, we did it. Why can't you? Well, that argument doesn't work so well with Republicans these days.
We're talking about the weekend news. It's On Point from NPR and WBUR. Aaron is calling from Detroit. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just wanted to say this. I appreciate what your guest said about I couldn't think of a more peaceful and respectful way to protest horrible behavior that's going on in our society. But what I think is being understated is how I believe that not only the football athletes, but every pro athlete, especially those that are not of color, should be participating in this, because this is about American values, about the right to protest, the right to state that you have a problem with something that's going on. That's what we were built on, rather than that being discouraged and bullied out by the president or somebody in an office of power. It should be encouraged in all of our society to be able to speak up freely about what you feel is wrong and therefore affect change. That's what we were built on.
Aaron, thanks for your call. I appreciate your comments. It's well taken. Margaret, as the mid, you know, people running in the midterms look at some of the divisive racial context and tensions coming up on the anniversary of Charlottesville, how are some of these candidates having to navigate the president's tweets and the undeniable tone that has been sent and the increased tensions?
I mean, as you can imagine, it varies district by district, and the House races play a little bit differently than the Senate races do. If you are running either to take over someone's Senate seat or as an incumbent senator, you have an entire state that you represent, and so you really have to cover the spectrum in terms of partisanship. But if you're running to retain or try to take over a House seat, you know, then the question is, how is that House seat drawn? Is it a swing district, or is it pretty solidly red or pretty solidly blue? And that is generally the answer for how the candidate runs. There are some Republican House lawmakers who have no interest in having President Trump come to their district and stump for them, and then others who do, and then some who are a little bit stuck in the middle. We heard some of these mixed reports about Troy Balderson in that special election, how much he really wanted President Trump there. I guess he'll get to do it all over again in November, and we'll find out. But for President Trump, he doesn't mind at all having this controversy over issues like free speech and whether, in fact, a professional athlete is allowed to have personal opinions, or whether they are just sort of performing, you know, there to perform for the team owners. He likes having that debate because it galvanizes his base, and his feeling is that base turnout is what will be most important to ensuring victory in some of these districts where Republicans are trying to hold their seats. It becomes a different question in the presidential year, I think, than it does in the midterm year. But for now, his calculation is that these sort of divisive controversies help him politically because they ensure base turnout in a year when base turnout is not usually as motivated.
Let's squeeze in one more call briefly. Connie, before the end of the hour, calling from Wisconsin.
Hi, Eric. Thank you for taking my call.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just wanted to quickly comment that it's not exciting, but we are a nation of laws. It's what we were founded on. And it seems our laws are up for sale depending on what social justice is popular, whether it's legal immigration, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, or even employment laws. It seems to be what's popular is ruling our nation rather than what we were founded on. And I think that's going to affect our ability to maintain our status as a superpower.
Thanks for your call. Michael Lindenberger, I'll give you the last word. Even in red state Texas, some of the scenes of family separations probably did not play well.
No, I don't think so. But, you know, it's an interesting point that was raised earlier about appealing to the base. I'm not sure that that's not wrong, that there are just enough people out there angry and supportive of Trump that his appeal to the lowest common denominator is going to help. I think there's some exceptions in Texas, even. That may be the Cruz race. We'll see.
Michael Lindenberger with the Dallas Morning News. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Margaret Tolev, senior White House correspondent with Bloomberg. Thank you as well.
Thank you, Eric.
And of course, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Have a good weekend, Jack.
Thank you, Eric.
And thanks to all our callers. Have a great weekend. You continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Monday, reporters help you prepare for the week ahead by breaking down the big news stories from the weekend and looking ahead. Thanks to all who called. I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to On Point.